Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of a Dhamma talk and Sangha discussion that introduces the Buddha's teachings. It includes a brief history of the Buddha and an overview of his Dhamma. This talk is presented at the introductory class for our 2016 Truth of Happiness Sangha Dhamma study on December 6, 2016 at Crossover Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace.
So, most of what you're going to hear tonight, you've heard me say before. But repetition is really a key part of the Dhamma. The Pali Canon is such a difficult read because of all the repetition, but the repetition is important just to get past our conditioned thinking and start implementing some of these unfamiliar ideas. So just to lay a brief foundation, the Buddha was born a prince in his father's kingdom about 2,600 years ago. He was given everything that any person could ever want. In fact, his father went overboard in making him extra comfortable with the idea that if he could just get his son enamored with palace life, he would never consider leaving the palace. And of course, we know that's not what happened. There's a story when the Buddha's recollecting his childhood. And he was thinking back to a time when he was 5 years old. And despite this incredible life that this kid was having, he was having a particularly difficult day and he was particularly disappointed in his life. And out of that frustration, this little five-year-old Siddhartha sat down under a tree and he started becoming mindful of the sensation of breathing. And he noticed after a short while that he felt better. He wasn't quite as disappointed in himself. And he finished that little sit-down and he got on with his life. And it would be 31 years later that he remembered that meditation method that he used to awaken. And it's the same meditation method that he taught for 45 years and that we're going to use tonight. The Buddha stayed in the palace for another until he was 29 years old, living a very, very cloistered and secluded life. His father was very careful to not let young Siddhartha be exposed to what was going on in the outside world for the fear that he would then want to find out what the problem is and is there anything he could do to solve it. He wanted his son to take over the throne. And luckily for us, it didn't work. At the age of 29, he left the palace grounds under the dark of night with a handler and his favorite horse. And he started wandering around town. And every time that he had been in the town up till that point, the king let everybody know. And he was only shown, it was kind of like going to China many, many years ago. You could only see certain parts. Well, he was only exposed to certain parts of the town. This was the first time that he was free to see anything that he wanted to see. And so on that trip, for the first time, he saw sickness, he saw aging, and he saw death. He came across a corpse laying on the ground. And all these things shocked him because he'd never seen them before. And even that, he asked his handler, Chanda, he says, "What is that? Why is that man sleeping on the side of the road?" He says, "He's not sleeping, he's dead." And the Buddha just had a hard time even comprehending that. And he walked into town and he started seeing the competitiveness and the aggressiveness of the people. Only because they were trying to survive in a very difficult time. The society and the life and the politics in a very real way were very, very similar back then as they are today. There was a lot of wars. There was a lot of violence. Every ill that you can talk about today, except maybe immediate annihilation, was present during the Buddha's time. And so he saw this for the first time. And it just shocked him. And at that point, he decided, "I have to figure out what is the cause of all this suffering that I see in the world? And is there a way to bring the cause of suffering to cessation? Is there a way to end this?" And that the corpse had a particular impact on the Buddha. He realized for the first time, if every human being ends up like that poor soul on the side of the road, what's the point of anything? And that's what he set out to understand. And so he left his father's palace and he started wandering around northern India. and he studied with some of the greatest spiritual teachers, Uttaka Ramaputta and Alara Kalama, who both taught different variations of the Vedas, which were present during the Buddhist time. The Vedas are the modern precursor, or the precursor to modern Hinduism. It wasn't called that. It was really just a... the teachers who taught the Vedas all had their own interpretation of it. And so there was a lot of different adaptations, but all of them were based in the Vedas. And the Buddha studied with these two foremost teachers, and he mastered their teachings very quickly and their meditation techniques. And he found both of them lacking, and not lacking in... not lacking in authenticity as far as what they were teaching, but lacking in developing the understanding that he was after, namely understanding the nature of suffering and if there were a way to bring that to cessation. The Vedas didn't address it. They addressed a way of worshiping, and you could even call it personal development, but personal development based on external beings, gods and goddesses, etc., and a lot of different intricate ways of doing this. And the Buddha found it confusing and not leading to the goal. So he rejected those teachers. They both offered him to come with them, and they could represent their teachings because he grasped these teachings so quickly. And he says, no, it's not for me. It's not what I'm looking for. And he met five other wandering ascetics, and they wandered around northern India practicing these very severe ascetic practices of breath control, denying every type of denial that you could even think of that the body needs just to survive. They cut it out of their life. It got to the point where the Buddha was living on a grain of rice or one bean a day. The idea behind that, and it's still practiced today, and there's still, I hope I don't get into it because it'll mean for a long, long class, there's still aspects of asceticism that are practiced in a conceptual way in a lot of modern Buddhism. Maybe I'll touch on that, maybe I won't. So after these years of this severe ascetic practices, the Buddha even recounts one time that he could touch his spine by touching the front of his belly. That's how emaciated he was. And remember, he was doing this. He was engaged in a sincere effort to use these practices to develop awakening. The idea was that if you could deny the body enough, that you'll free the mind from the body. And again, that's still a common practice today. So one day he's walking down the road. Very sick from these severe ascetic practices, very unhealthy, and he passed out, and he rolled down the side of the road into a river, and a young girl, Sujata, 11, dragged him out of the river and nursed him back to health. And as he started regaining some of his strength, out of frustration, he realized that all the things he'd been doing up until that point didn't get him any closer to the goal except to realize what the practice shouldn't be. And he decided, with strong resolve or right intention, to sit in meditation until he awakens. And he remembered that simple meditation method that he had used when he was 5 years old. And that's what he did. And he sat under the Bodhi tree. That tree is still there, by the way. It's all its grandchildren around. And I haven't been there, but I've seen, you can take the camera view around, and it looks kind of like Canal Street on a bizarre day. I mean, it's not what you'd expect where the Buddha awakened. It's a place to spend a lot of money. But it's still there. So the Buddha sat down, and I'm going to sit here until I understand what I want to understand. And during that meditation session, then the legend is anywhere from one day to 40 days, and the time isn't important. What's important is the Buddha actually awakened here. He came across every one of his self-referential views. He recognized them as self-referential views that were rooted in impermanence, and he rejected every one. A better word probably is abandoned them or renounced them as having no real substance. And he did this repeatedly for the 40 days that he was meditating. And at the end of this meditation session, the morning star arose. I'm just saying that because it's not all that significant, but that's how it's told. The morning star arose, the Buddha looked up, and he realized. He realized who he was in relation to impermanence. He understood that his own contributions to his stress and his confusion. In the text, the self-referential views that the Buddha was coming up against during his meditation are depicted as the benevolent god Mara. In other words, Mara had come into his consciousness and was trying to distract him off his cushion. Mara sent great armies at the Buddha to scare him off his cushion, and herds of elephants to scare him off his cushion. Mara sent his three beautiful daughters to entice him off his cushion. And every one of these things, the Buddha was really, Mara is metaphor for what's going on in his own mind, his different confused levels of consciousness. He recognized every one of these as impermanent, as simply aspects of self-referential views, rejected everyone, and he awakened. What he awakened to is dependent origination. He realized that he was ignorant of the true nature of the world, which he described in his first teaching as the Four Noble Truths. And we'll touch on dependent origination in week 8 and probably week 8 and week 9, but just for now, dependent origination states that from initial ignorance through 12 observable causative links, all manner of confusion, delusion, and suffering arises. So if the problem is ignorance, then the solution must be wisdom, isn't it? And so since the solution is wisdom, that's what he taught on his very first teaching he ever taught. It's called the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. And he presented this sutta to the five buddies that he'd been wandering around northern India with. Before he gave that teaching, he sat off and on in meditation for another 2 weeks, considering very carefully if it was possible to teach what he understood in a way that would be useful for other human beings. And if not, why even bother? In fact, he realized that if he put something out there that was even more confusing, that could not be applied directly to a human life, he's actually contributing to suffering, and he didn't want to do that. And so for those 2 weeks, he was considering, how can I teach this, understanding what I know about humanity? And the thing that he was considering is our own inherent conditioned thinking. Modern psychiatrists call the confirmation bias today. It means that we're biased towards seeing things that confirm an already established view, confirmation bias or conditioned thinking. And he was considering, how can I get past that conditioned thinking? How can I get past, well, do me a favor and turn that instead of hollering all night. It's warm enough in here, I think. Everybody's warm enough? And you don't want to hear me yell. Especially during a Dhamma class. It'll take 2 minutes to go up. I don't want to wait for Ram to come back. Do you see it, Ram? Oh, he's got it. Yeah. Thank you, Ram. So he seriously considered, how can I get through this common human problem of conditioned thinking? How can I get through these hardened views? And he developed an Eightfold Path precisely for doing that. And that is the primary reason why he developed an Eightfold Path. Because he understood the common human problem of conditioned thinking. How am I going to get past it? Through this path. And the path is designed as a framework for recognizing and abandoning our conditioned views. That Eightfold Path, the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path, is Shamatha Vipassana meditation, the meditation method that he used to awaken. And so the reason why I'm saying that is, don't look at the path as a linear path. In other words, it starts with right view, 8 more links, it ends up in right meditation. We develop meditation first, and I'll talk a little bit more about that as I continue this introduction. So we taught a meditation method primarily for deepening our concentration so that we could develop the refined mindfulness. The concentration is the foundation now that we can build our refined mindfulness to hold in mind all factors of the Eightfold Path as we develop our life. So mindfulness means to recollect or to hold in mind. You can look at what we're developing in the Eightfold Path as developing very specific skills so that very specific tasks can be accomplished. And those tasks are developing each factor of the Eightfold Path. In other words, when we get to right view is the initial view that I don't know everything, that I'm lacking something, that I'm ignorant of something. I'm ignorant of something very specific, Four Noble Truths. That's the beginning of developing right view. Profound right view, the Buddha described, and it's up on that board. Profound right view is a view that completely and profoundly understands stress, has abandoned the individual contributions to stress, craving and clinging, has experienced, has seen, has viewed the cessation of stress in their lives, disappointing experiences, and it's a view that has fully developed the Eightfold Path. So right view relates to each factor of the Four Noble Truths in that way. And the task to develop is developing profound right view. Is it clear how I'm explaining it this way, that they're tasked to develop? The reason why I'm emphasizing that is it's not that these aren't belief systems that we develop. We don't develop a belief in right view or a belief in right intention. There's nothing taken on faith at all in the Buddhist teaching. It's all a direct experience. So the direct experience of developing right view is that profound right view that the Buddha described. So he tells us what to do and he shows us the result, but not in a conceptual way, a very practical way. The next factor of the Eightfold Path is right intention. Right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. So that's the task to develop. Right speech, right action, and right livelihood, the virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path, follow the same way. The task to develop right speech is to recognize initially when we might be engaged in wrong speech, such as gossip or lying, exaggeration in any form, unnecessary speech, hurtful speech in any way. So we know as we deepen our concentration almost immediately, we can then hold in mind that quality of mind, that quality of speech, of right speech. So when we find ourselves maybe gossiping, we'll be able to recognize it and stop it. That's all. So the skill of concentration allows us to develop the task of developing right speech and right view, right livelihood. Is that clear? And again, I'm emphasizing this to look at it in this way. The next factor is right effort. Right effort means that we need to put our effort in. If we want a meditation practice, you have to meditate. That's the beginning of right effort. But we also have to develop the broader framework of the Eightfold Path as right effort relates to the Dhamma practice. Right mindfulness is the seventh factor. And just by using the word, you could use right mindfulness or skillful mindfulness or appropriate mindfulness. As opposed to right and wrong, some people get caught up in that as a moral way. I just think it's the clearest way. So if there's such a thing as right mindfulness, the Buddha is implying that there is such a thing as wrong mindfulness. So if you remember that mindfulness means to recollect or to hold in mind, we can do that with anything, can't we? For a long time, I was using Robert Oppenheimer, who developed the atomic bomb, as a good example of this. He had an incredible level of concentration, and he was able to hold in mind the qualities necessary to develop this horrible device, isn't it? That's an aspect of mindfulness that may have, and you can debate whether it was good or bad. I don't want to get into it. Just using that as an example, that's an example of mindfulness that may have been used for hurtful purposes. On a personal level, I think most of you know, I don't want to shock anybody, but I'm a recovered alcoholic and a drug addict. I used mindfulness to keep myself going all those years that I kept going. There was nothing more mindful than an alcoholic that can't get out of his mind the next drink or the next drug. That's an aspect of mindfulness that kills people. So just using the term mindfulness doesn't necessarily mean that it's all wonderful. The way we apply mindfulness, what we hold in mind, will determine the experience that we have in our life. And the Buddha taught mindfulness in two very specific ways. One is the four foundations of mindfulness that I'll touch on in a minute. And the other was to be mindful of the Eightfold Path, of each factor of the Eightfold Path. That makes sense, doesn't it? That's the type of useful mindfulness that's applied in the Dhamma. And that's not to say that we shouldn't apply mindfulness in other ways. Quite a few people here have taken an MBSR class, mindfulness-based stress reduction. Jon Kabat-Zinn has done an incredible job using mindfulness to address physical problems and now even emotional problems, and he's been very successful. Those are useful applications of mindfulness. It's just different than the mindfulness that's engaged within the Eightfold Path. The final factor of the Eightfold Path is right meditation or shamatha vipassana meditation. And again, we're going to talk about that in a minute. The structure of our course now, we begin tonight with, I'll introduce shamatha vipassana meditation, which we just did. And then you'll read up on that chapter, the introduction and the chapter on shamatha vipassana meditation. Then you'll come back next week and we'll discuss that, and then I'll introduce the following week. The following week is the four foundations of mindfulness. And again, the four foundations of mindfulness are form, feeling, perceptions. No, it's not. That's just five clinging aggregates. Form, feelings, thoughts, and the resulting or ongoing thoughts and the resulting consciousness. So form is simply recognizing that I have a physical form and I'm bringing that form into meditation. Being mindful of the sensation of breathing, really the first foundation of mindfulness, being recognizing that I have a breath in the body brings my mind into what's occurring and it brings my mind into the present moment. The second foundation of mindfulness is feelings, recognizing that feelings are arising. The third foundation is thoughts impacting feelings and feelings driving those thoughts. and the fourth foundation of mindfulness is the resulting quality of mind from that interaction of feelings and thoughts. So when I give that instruction, the last instruction I give at the end of meditation, notice the quality of your mind, is referring to that fourth quality of mindfulness, fourth foundation of mindfulness. The four foundations of mindfulness are taught primarily to use in meditation practice, in a dispassionate way. The reason why the Buddha taught something as obvious that we have feelings and thoughts is to develop a dispassionate look at them during meditation. So as we become mindful of the sensation of breathing, we start to relax, we start to deepen concentration, and maybe for the first time in our lives, we start noticing feelings coming up that in a way that we're able to actually notice it and not react to it. And those feelings can often lead to a thought. I don't like this feeling. I like this feeling. Where did this feeling come from? You might be remembering an argument you had early in the day, and your next thought is, how could that person make me feel this way? Feelings drive thoughts. Sometimes it's the other way around. Sometimes it's a thought arises, we have a memory, and that drives a feeling. The point of the four foundations of mindfulness and meditation is to simply develop a dispassionate awareness of that occurring during meditation. And so, as we're being mindful of the sensation of breathing, and we notice a feeling came up, and it might be a feeling of fear that just came up, we don't even know where it's from, you don't have to figure it out. Recognize that a feeling has arisen, come back to the sensation of breathing. And what we're doing in a very direct and profound way is interrupting that process of going from a feeling to a thought construct and a fabrication. We're no longer getting caught up in our thoughts, and we're developing the ability to control our thoughts. If you came to the retreat, you remember the Takasanthana Sutta, the Buddha teaches that we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it. In other words, we're in control of our thoughts, and if we're in control of our thoughts, we're in control of the way we live our lives all the time. If we're not, then we're going to constantly start doing things out of reaction and out of impulse. And in a lot of ways, that's how our lives feel like they get away from us. We've lost control of our thoughts. So again, the second week is the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, and we'll get into that a little bit more. The next week is the Four Noble Truths. So we'll review that very first teaching that the Buddha gave. The next 3 weeks are on the Eightfold Path. The first two factors are the wisdom factors of right view and right intention. The next week will be on the virtuous factors of right speech, action, and livelihood. And the sixth week will be on the concentration factors of right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. The seventh week, which may be, I might break it up into 2 weeks, is on the three marks of existence, anicca, anatta, and dukkha. And that is, the three marks of existence are really what we're developing an awareness of in the context of the Eightfold Path. Now, when Kandana, who was one of the Buddha's friends that he first gave this teaching to, the first teaching on the Four Noble Truths, Kandana listened to this teaching, and he said to Buddha, he said, I think I got it. He says, all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. And the Buddha said, bingo. He didn't say bingo, I say bingo. Mm-hmm. He said, you got it. I now call you Anakandana, meaning the one who understands. Hearing the four noble truths for the... Now remember, Kandana had been practicing for many years along with the Buddha, so he had a fertile field for developing understanding. And what he was referring to was not simply a sandwich going moldy, all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. He was really talking about himself in relation to the world and the views that he was holding up until that point. And ultimately, it is our held views and our thoughts that we recognize most profoundly in relation to impermanence. In meditation, as your concentration deepens, you'll recognize that every one of your thoughts is an impermanent thought, as long as you're not attached to it, as long as you're not clinging one thought to the next thought. That's called spaciousness. A lot of people describe when they start meditating, they seem to have more spaciousness in their thinking. Well, you do. There's not quite as tight a spot between thoughts anymore. You've created a little space between your thoughts. And that space widens and widens until we get to the point where we're able to think what we want to think when we want to think it. In other words, it's just space. filled with the thoughts that we need to think in order to thrive as human beings. The next week will be on dependent origination in the five clinging aggregates, week 8. And again, I think that's going to be 2 weeks too. And I've been questioned a few times, especially by online students. If Buddha awakened to dependent origination, why don't you teach that first and then teach everything that follows? And there's actually a way to do that. We did that on retreat, this past retreat. But it has to be kept in context. And even at the retreat, I didn't teach dependent origination until I laid a strong foundation. The Buddha did not teach dependent origination as his first teaching. In fact, it's hard to determine. The Pali Canon is the record of the Buddha's teachings that's still extant in the world today. There's a very good reason to take it on that it's authentic, and I won't get into that tonight. You got to trust me on it. But you can read it, too. There's an article on the website called The Pali Canon that explains that. In the Pali Canon, nothing is written in chronological order, so it's very difficult to just read it and say, well, the Buddha said this during his first year of teaching and this during his fifth year, and this. You just can't determine that. But you can, when you read enough of the canon, you can get an idea of the settings when he gave these teachings. And again, there's no way of knowing when he taught dependent origination the first time, but it likely was not for the first 3 months, and I think it was probably not for at least another year into his teaching. And the reason why is the same reason I put it 8th in the book rather than the first, is that you need a context to understand dependent origination before it has any value at all. And by the time you have developed the first 7 weeks, you'll understand how to apply dependent origination in the Dhamma. If I walked up to you on a street and I said, you know what, it's ignorance of 12 observable causative links that cause all suffering, and walked away, you're going to think, boy, I'm glad he didn't have anything else to say to me. It doesn't make any sense, does it? And it doesn't. Out of context, it's completely useless teaching, which is why the Buddha never taught anything that was out of context. Everything the Buddha taught for the 45 years of his teaching career was taught in the context of Four Noble Truths. And that is the only way to understand. If you take any sutta, if you took the Vitakasanthana Sutta out of context, if you don't know how to apply it, it makes no sense. There's probably not a sutta except the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta that makes sense because it's in context. But as we develop the course, we'll be able to keep... In fact, the reason why I wrote the course the way I did is to develop the context necessary to develop complete understanding. The next week that we'll touch, the 9th week, is on karma and rebirth. And again, the reason why that's 9th and not somewhere in the middle is because you really don't have the context to understand what karma is until you get to that point. And honestly, most of us, it takes more than just one run-through to really understand karma. But mostly it's because of the conditioned thinking that we have. Karma has been portrayed for many years as kind of like a dark cloud hanging over you. Something bad happens, you got bad karma, or I got a bad karma day. It has nothing to do with that. And when good things happen, it's not necessarily because you are being bestowed with some good karma. Karma is the present moment unfolding of our past intentional acts, moderated by the present level of our mindfulness. Which means that if our mindfulness hasn't evolved from that state of ignorance, then anything that occurs that's unfolding, our karma unfolding right now, can only be seen in the view of that ignorant view and will only contribute to further karma. Karma, when it's seen in the right view, meaning we have developed the framework of the Eightfold Path to understand what's occurring, and our minds are well concentrated, as my life unfolds now, I understand that that what's occurring right here in this moment is the result of my past intentional actions. But because I've developed deep concentration and a refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, now I won't react to that, to what's occurring. I won't say, why is this happening to me? How could this happen to me? Where am I going? What do I need? In the moment, I'll stay present with what's occurring. My mind will be calm, and I will not contribute anything additional. I won't create any more karma. Is that clear? At least as clear as it needs to be tonight? So just for tonight, it's enough to understand that karma is something that we directly contribute to, and we can directly alter. And we're the only ones that contribute to our karma, and can alter our karma in any way. It's an individual deal. There's a little aspect of this that I should touch on now, but we'll talk more about it in week 9. The things, the The worldly causes and conditions, the things that happen in the world, a terrible flood or an earthquake or just a rainy day, that's not an aspect of our karma. It really, to me, it's so hurtful when I hear things like this terrible flood and all these people drowned and they had some bad karma for that to happen. That's such a hurtful and mean thing to say. For one thing, it's not true, but even to think about that, that these people deserve something terrible that happened. I'm just thinking about something happened. I won't get into it. Still bothers me. They blame certain diseases on people. You know, it's just crazy. That's their karma. They deserve it. That's not it. Karma is a present moment unfolding of our past intentional acts moderated by the present level of our mindfulness. So if we can deepen our mindfulness, then we can affect our karma in such a way that we can bring it to cessation, which leads to rebirth. And again, we'll touch more on this in week 9. But rebirth is not primarily a teaching about what we can do to give ourselves more favorable births in the future. In fact, it has very little to do with that, although it does touch on it. But it's not important to get into past lives or future lives as far as the Dhamma is concerned. The Dhamma is entirely concerned with what's occurring in this human life, period. So what's important to know about karma and rebirth is that if we understand karma, and we will by week 9, then we understand that each moment holds the potential to give birth to either another ignorant moment or another moment that's grounded in wisdom. And that's the most important aspect of rebirth. What am I giving birth to in this moment? And I said it before, what we hold in mind will determine what my next experience in life will be, whether it's this next moment or 20 years down the line. What we hold in mind right now. And that's really the important teaching of karma and rebirth. The last week of the course is on hindrances, which is a really simple and direct teaching, but it's at the right place. Because one of the things that we should remember now while we're going through the course, and it's just a suggestion, but as you're developing this course and as you're going through the Dhamma study, to try to keep your focus within the Dhamma. In other words, if you're engaged in other practices outside of this practice, maybe different meditation techniques, maybe just different philosophies, put them aside for 10 weeks as best you can and just focus on developing this understanding. And you'll find it much easier to do and much less confusing. And then after that, you can do anything you want anytime you want, but it's best during this 10 weeks to keep your focus on here. And one of the things that I suggest, and I just had a very interesting conversation with an online student that just finished the course, I don't call the Dhamma a spiritual practice, but I will in this sense, just because we can all identify. As a spiritual practice, I'm not going to call it a spiritual practice, it doesn't fit. As a philosophy of personal development, the Dhamma stands alone. And when we try to add to it or accommodate it in any way, then it gets confusing and much is lost. So we can do anything we want in life, of course we can, we're free to do anything we want, but as far as a Dhamma practice, keep it focused on what the Buddha actually taught, and you'll find that it's very easy and rather simple to develop. It might take a little bit of time, but what I've found, and I've studied just about everything that's out there that has the label Buddhism, is that for me, when I try to incorporate everything that's called Buddhism, I just got more and more confused. When I finally came back to what the Buddha actually taught and settled on that, and practice, remember the talk a couple weeks ago on the wisdom of restraint. When I practice, and it was hard for me. I'm the kind of person, probably like all of you, that I just want to learn everything there is out there. And I want to apply it to me in a certain way. I know this. I want to create a view of it. So I wanted to have the most vast knowledge there is of Buddhism in the world. And I got news for you. There's no head that's big enough to hold all that in. And mine wasn't. It wasn't until I said, let me just focus on what the Buddha taught, what I can find that the Buddha actually taught, and it's still available to us today, that's when everything changed. That's when all the things that I was looking for many, many years, just fell into place, and rather quickly. It's when meditation finally made sense. I went on many, many, Melanie was talking about silent retreats. I went on many, many silent retreats and sesshins with 14 hours of meditation, and the best thing I got out of those things is they came to an end. Honestly, and I'm not putting them down, and there's many people that got a lot of benefit out of it. For me, it was really just, it was just painful. It wasn't, and I, again, you've been on retreats with me, you know I don't teach silent retreats. It was a useful way of practicing silence. Getting to that, to meditation now, you've all heard me teach, when you're starting meditation, start with short periods of time and build it up gradually. The reason for that is that thing that the Buddha was concerned about, conditioned thinking. If we try to do too much too fast, we're just going to get frustrated and say, this isn't for me, this practice doesn't work. But I've yet to meet anybody that started a meditation practice and started with short periods of meditation, was not able to develop a full-fledged practice. And there's quite a few in this room that started just that way. Did you want to comment?
Were
you...
No, I'm scratching. I mean, in an auction, you didn't move.
So I've given you an overview of the what we're going to be doing the next 10 weeks. I hope I've given you a little enthusiasm about it, too. Are there any questions now? I mean, most of you have a perspective of having been through the course, but do you have any questions just in general about taking the course? Where to go with it, what to do with it? Does everybody understand the structure of the course, why I laid it out the way I did? And no questions about that? Okay. I always want to go around the room. So let's go around the room. I want to hear how your practice is going, and if you do have any individual questions, we'll start with Matt. Good to see you, Matt.
Good to see you, John. Good to see everybody for this new 12-week course. Practice is going well. I'm just really grateful for these teachings and for the practice, and that we get to do this again.
Yeah, me too.
Thanks. Stefan, good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Yeah, my practice is going well also, and it feels really nice to be starting this course again and kind of restarting everything. Yeah.
Glad you're here. Mike, good to see you.
Hey, John. The risk of repeating myself again and again, the only thing consistent about my practice is its inconsistency. So I'm really looking forward to starting off, as I spoke with you the other day, about just starting fresh from here and kind of turning a new page and trying to really stick with it going forward like this.
Yeah,
I get a little discipline for myself, which I usually need in all levels of my life.
The most useful aspect of, one of the most useful aspects of a Sangha is just that. It gives us discipline. We know next week I'm going to be there, so let me sit today and keep going. And even that impermanence prevails even within the Dhamma. So even though most of us have been through this course before, I think you're going to find that you'll gain new insights in how to apply this and how it applies to you. And that's really, that could be a lot of fun. These things I never saw before, and there it was right in front of my nose. So glad you're here, Mike. Ram, good to see you.
Looking forward to it. One of the last things you mentioned about abandoning old views and different views on Buddhism and spirituality in general. I had to drop a whole bunch of stuff over the last year, and I'm almost excited to get into this course again with kind of a fresh look, and see how far I can whittle it down this time.
I'm glad you're here. So you, if you think about the very first teaching the Buddha gave, that was the first time in human history that we know about that these things called the Four Noble Truths were presented. It was a fresh look at the world. Most of the monks and nuns were involved in some type of spiritual practice that they had to recognize and abandon when it was confusing to them. They had to let it go. And again, the Dhamma is all about recognizing and abandoning self-referential views, views that no longer serve us, including the view that we might have of Dhamma practice up till today. It's likely going to change a little bit. That's that refined mindfulness. Andrew, good to see you tonight.
Good evening. Well, I continue to persevere, and that's the best I can say for myself.
There's even a word for that, Kshanti.
Kshanti.
Patient forbearance. We all need it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad you're here tonight, Andrew. Mark, good to see you.
Practice is going well. I'm with Matt.
not right in the moment. It's somewhat soon after. So I'm grateful for that, and I fully believe that I'll hear some new things that you've probably said before, but I didn't hear quite that same way, because I always hear something new, even if it's the same talk again. Looking forward to that too.
Yeah. I am too. Glad you're here. Mary, it's good to see you.
It's good to be here. I'm still enjoying the effects of the retreat on Sunday. Had a really good day today, as a matter of fact. And I'm really looking forward to, I don't even know if I knew what I was stepping into just about a year ago when I started. I was just having dinner with my sisters and and came along, and it's really been life-changing, and I know that I'll just deepen my practice and gain new insights from starting again.
Yeah.
So I'm very happy to be here.
I am too. Glad you're here. Helen, good to see you.
Good to be here. Ditto what Mary said, you know, increasing the depth of each of the layers and putting things all in context. I think all of that would be improved. I also wanted to share with Matt that I've used some of our exercises before my meditation last night and Monday as well, or Monday morning and Monday night as well. That was a very nice addition.
Yeah, you found it supportive of your meditation practice.
Yeah,
yeah.
I did.
Really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice. Good. Thank you. Diane, how are you tonight?
Yeah. I'm well, and thank you for your steadfastness and doing what you do. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you. What else would I do?
No,
I don't know. That's all I know.
I'm glad to participate in the class as well. I was thinking, if I were a new person and listened to how he just said, I would be really, really confused. Because a lot, I mean, I was amazed at myself that I could follow, actually, what you were saying. And whenever you paused and said, is that clear? Does everybody understand that? And then there was silence, and I was thinking, well, okay. Maybe it'd take too much time to interrupt. But so if you have any of those feelings, don't be discouraged. It really gets better. And I just think, one of the things I was thinking when you were talking in, you know, a brief moment between your thoughts and my thoughts, and was I'm not worried about going anywhere. I'm not worried about a destination anymore. I'm not worried about arriving. And that's, I mean, don't tell anybody I said that, but on the outside world, but it, like my son, but I'm really okay with that, and that's a gift. That's a gift from my practice. It's a gift from the teachings. It's a gift. And thank you. I'm very grateful. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. We're all grateful for you.
Right.
Bonnie, how are you tonight?
I'm good, thank you. Just practicing, and sort of like looking at everything like the layers of an onion and the layers of, so, you know, like Helen was saying, just you keep deepening the understanding as we keep going around. Okay. And the cycle of looking and bringing all the experience that I already have to it. So,
Glad you're here, Bonnie. Liz, how are you?
I'm
doing really well. I feel like I had a little bit of a breakthrough today on my walk. I was thinking about Sunday and some of the things that Matt said and some of the things that Lorna said, and I was listening to the five clinging aggregates again on as I was walking. I had my headset on, and I just feel like I developed a better understanding of feelings as they relate to craving and clinging. And the Sunday we were talking about how things feel in our body and how things feel when certain things arise. And so I just feel like I made a better connection to that and how, you know, the whole idea of feelings and reactiveness to things, you know, is based in clinging and craving. And how do we move closer to understanding, not just on the surface what the clinging and craving is about, but more deeply, and then how to abandon all that. So I found I slipped through a keyhole or something, but I just feel like I have a better understanding, and that was like an essential thing for me to understand. The next is anatta, but I felt like that whole the relationship and recognizing clinging and craving, I felt like I needed something like a trigger to have me think about it in the moment that it was occurring. So as a feeling arises, what exactly is that? Not to get into the analytical stuff, but just to say, what is it in this moment that I need to release? And then, of course, you know, take that as a baby step to, I lost the word, but sort of carrying that with me.
Yeah.
You know, how do you integrate that? So, I think some things are starting to sink in a little bit. So. And I'm very grateful for that. And we were just talking about how lucky we are that the proximity of the center is to our lives, that we can get here,
yeah,
and we can participate, and we can be engaged and involved, and so I'm thankful for all of that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Everything you put into
this. Thank you. You describe beautifully how the framework of the Eightfold Path works in the moment to provide true insight into what's most important in our lives. You know, that's, and in some ways it seems, I don't want to say miraculous, but it seems almost special when you see something, but it really is a part of that whole process that you've been engaged with for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
You know? You've developed a view, enough of a right view to see things in right view, correctly, in relation to reality. Thank you for sharing. Lorna, good to see you tonight.
Thank you. Good to be here. And thank you for all your efforts throughout the year. I was also thinking about the one-day retreat on Sunday. And I think I mentioned in the retreat that sometimes you can feel in your body when you are not lining up with the Eightfold Path. You have a resistance and you feel uncomfortable, etc. I've also begun to think, or observing myself, that whenever I have a situation or say something or do something or something is said to me or whatever, and I feel now that I can be aware if I sort of put it into my ego box or my ego trunk or whatever I have. You can feel when you've just accepted something as somebody has just said something and you've just heard the that's awesome. But sometimes when you hear something or see something, you can feel that you're putting it to your ego. And I think that's something that I'm becoming more and more aware of as well. And you have, not that I can recall anyway, I don't think that you've actually spoken about, if you have that moment, you know, where you are, your ego goes whoop, you know, and you expand a bit and you get all, you know, high on the occasion or whatever, you know. I mean, what, you just, how do you feel with that moment?
I remind myself I'm probably not the greatest person that ever lived. I just may not be that. Does that answer your question? I'm not saying you're doing it. I'm saying you ask me what I do. What I do. And if I don't, usually something happens pretty quickly that shows me that. Yeah. I may not be happy about it because I don't have the right view, but I'm sorry. You're absolutely right. As you develop just a little bit of refinement in your thinking, you recognize when you're associating yourself with something and you're attaching yourself. It's a palpable feeling. And when you do it, what do? You say, wait a minute, this is not me. This is not mine. This is not who I am. It's surprising, and it took me a while to figure out why. The Buddha used the word, I don't remember the Pali word, but the translation is association. He used that word association often to describe clinging. But it really is a useful way when you think about how we associate with things. You know, it could be a concept such as a political party, but it also could be associating with another person. Or an object, you know. I always talk about chocolate. I'm a chocolate cake person. You know? I got to get a lot of chocolate cake if I'm going to be happy. That's an association, and we form those associations all the time if we don't have a restrained mind, if we don't understand we're doing it. But because you're able to describe it to yourself, I mean, thank you for describing it to us. But because you're able to see it and describe it, you're able to interrupt it. You first have to see the process going on. It's like that, I say it often, this teacher I had years ago, Arnold Patton, the one thing I remember, a few other things I remember, he said that if you're in New York and you want to get to Chicago, but you believe you're in Los Angeles, you ain't going nowhere. You got to know what you have to change. You got to know where you are. What are you doing for yourself? What are you doing to yourself? What are you creating in your life right now that needs to be different? That's the potential in each moment. And it all comes down to our thinking. Before right intention, the second factor of the Eightfold Path, is sometimes called right thinking. Because before we can do anything, we first have to have the thought to before I can walk out the door, I first have to think it's time to walk out the door. Probably it's going to be subconscious. I won't realize, but I have to have the thought. Before we can do anything or go anywhere in our life, we have to think it. And if we can gain control of our thoughts, then we can gain control of our life. It really is that simple. So thank you for pointing that out, how the process goes. Joe, good to see you tonight.
Nice, good to be here. This is my second week, so my practice is a week old. The good news is that I have one.
Yeah.
And that you're here.
Yeah, it's good to be here. I started with the guided meditations, and then at some point during the week realized I should probably read the first chapter of the book that he gave me, because it was going to be the subject matter for tonight. And I was doing it wrong. I was thinking about it wrong anyway. And probably beating myself up over the technicalities. And it was nice to read that the thoughts, that putting space between thoughts was more of a goal than, or was a part of it that I didn't realize was a part of it. And I'm able to do that. I was prepared before I read the first chapter to come here and say that the group meditations are easier. It's easier here than it is by myself. And that's, I don't know why. I'm glad you're a purist, because I am also in other disciplines. I always like want the source. I want to learn what the originator of whatever discipline it is. So I'm glad for that. I'm really lucky that this exists here close to me, because it seems to be what I've been looking for a long time. And I guess that's what I have.
Well, thank you, John. I'm so glad you're here. You touched on something. Don't ever judge yourself harshly. Be very gentle with yourself. Remember that meditation is primarily for deepening concentration. If you remember that and you just engage in a technique, then every meditation is effective. You know, it's when we start judging ourselves. I should be more mindful of my breath. How come I can't be mindful of my breath? It just doesn't matter. Somebody asked me a while ago. It was the first time the question was ever, how long can you be mindful of your breath? And I couldn't answer it because I don't know. But I took a guess. I said, maybe 3 or 4 minutes. But again, I've never timed it, so I really don't know. But that's not the goal. Every time that I find myself caught up in my thoughts again, it's a success when I remember that and come back to the sensation of breathing, because I'm deepening concentration. I'm creating spaciousness. I don't know that anybody's ever able to just be mindful of your breath for 20, 30, 40 minutes. I don't know. I can't, and I've been meditating for 37 years. But I don't care. It doesn't matter. What's important is to develop meditation as it's presented, use your meditation sessions wisely, and develop the other factors of the Eightfold Path, and then we're good to go. The other wonderful thing about developing the Eightfold Path as a framework, once it's integrated into our lives, it brings great freedom because we don't have to be overanalyzing everything that's occurring. We know that if we're able to maintain that mindfulness of the Eightfold Path and act accordingly, we're good to go. We're not going to do any harm to other people, we won't do any harm to ourselves, and we'll be able to develop full human maturity, a full awakening. You know, that's why it's such a wonderful thing. It's right there for us. Melanie, welcome to our Sangha.
Very happy to be here. Like I said, finally after a year wanting to come.
I'm glad you're here.
I guess something that keeps coming to my mind while everybody's speaking is, for me, it's like someone said to me once, Melanie, you think too much. And my response, because I always go to humor, is, you know what, I thought about that.
And you're right. That sounds like something I'd say.
Yeah.
You fit right in.
I'm sorry.
Welcome to the Sangha.
And then, you know, things about parenting came up while everybody was speaking too, because I think I bring a lot of expectations to parenting, and I have two teenagers, and I'm really excited about doing this course for many reasons, but one of them is maybe that having less expectations will also trickle over into all of that.
Yes.
So that's why I do find it exciting, and I'm glad that this is the first session and I was able to come today.
Well, I'm glad you. Does anybody have any, you know, anything to add to that that has children and had this practice affect that? I think we'll leave it alone.
Yeah. For me, it's usually the last thing I can apply it to.
Well, that's the first noble truth, point one. Children are dukkha. I'm glad you're here. Judy, how are you tonight? You thought I forgot you, didn't you?
No. Well, my practice, I'm happy to say, is back on track, so it's much more consistent this week. And it makes a difference in my week, in my day, everything.
Yeah.
But, it's really all. I don't have anything else, but thank you.
I'm glad you're here for me. You're welcome for everything. Thank you all for everything. So that was a good start. Joe, you kind of jumped the gun, because our homework is to read the introduction in the first chapter. And then we'll come back and talk about it next week, and then I'll introduce the Four Foundations of Mindfulness next week. I can't think of anything else. No? Anything? I feel like I'm leaving something out. I always had a bunch of announcements. We've had a really busy couple of months here. There's nothing going on except the Dhamma study now. So you can just relax and take it easy. And again, remember to be very, very gentle with yourself. This isn't something, just because the book is written as a 10-week course, that you have to get it in 10 weeks. It just lays the foundation, as you've seen, for ongoing development and deepening concentration and for developing a life of lasting peace and happiness. It's really possible for us. So that's it for tonight. We'll finish with metta, my words on metta instead of the Buddha's words. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And in metta, the first object of our meditation is always ourselves. In generating feelings of deep love and compassion for the object of our meditation, may I be filled with love and kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy. May I be filled with love and kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy. May I be filled with love and kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy. And now bring to mind those that are close to you, and generating those same feelings of love and compassion for the objects of our meditation. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. And may they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. And now bring to mind those you may be in conflict with, difficult relationships, and generating those same feelings of love and compassion for the objects of our meditation. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. And now bring to mind each other in this room this evening and all the other members of our Sangha, and extend your awareness outside of this room, across our community, across our planet, across all creation, to include all sentient beings, and generating those same feelings of deep love and compassion for all sentient beings. May all sentient beings be filled with love and kindness. May all sentient beings be well. May all sentient beings be peaceful and at ease. May all sentient beings be happy. May all sentient beings be filled with love and kindness. May all sentient beings be well. May all sentient beings be peaceful and at ease. May all sentient beings be happy. May all sentient beings be filled with love and kindness. May all sentient beings be well. May all sentient beings be peaceful and at ease. May all sentient beings be happy. This concludes our Dhamma study for this evening. Thank you all for being here. Peace.
Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.